Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me as tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger, by now well known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights. Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas. With all the more troublesome news of late, and all of us a bit ill at ease amidst a state of unrest and uncertainty, tonight's show looks to something perhaps a little less serious, at least to most of us, shareholder activism.
Here, individuals purchase shares of a corporation with the purpose of reinventing or changing the corporation in some way that others might find disruptive or distressing.
As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and to answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area or out of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And again, if you want us to pick up the freight, call us at 866-798-8255. To help us sort out just what's going on out there, Derek Zaba is a partner and co-chair of the shareholder activism practice at Sidley Austin LLP, one of the world's premier law firms.
Attorney David J. Berger is a partner at Wilson, Sonsini, Goodrich & Rosati, a firm that is all but legendary within the local bars. They represented many of the early IPOs, establishing what we now know as Silicon Valley. David chairs the firm's corporate governance group.
To each of you, one and all, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
I thought we'd start off with an explanation of what is shareholder activism. And I'll start by saying I'm still taken aback. We were talking before the show, and what I thought shareholder activism was, it turns out it's likely completely different. I always had in mind people buying shares and changing the company for the corporate good. But Derek and David let me know that Gordon Gekko, who was from the movie Wall Street, Greed is Good, was a shareholder activist. I never thought about it that way. So perhaps they could explain what is shareholder activism. And for those of us who have a few gray hairs in our beard, use it, Gordon Gekko.
So this is David, and thank you very much for having us here. It's a great pleasure and honor. Shareholder activism is about someone coming into the company, an investor who buys shares and tries to change that company from what it's doing into something different. And Gordon Gekko is the ideal example. If you remember the movie Wall Street, what happened there is Charlie Sheen was an advisor to Gordon Gekko, a young analyst, and he came in and Gordon put him in charge of trying to take over the airline. And the airline had financial problems, and Charlie Sheen convinced Gordon to put money in with the hope that he would acquire the airline and invest in it. And they were going to use the union's money to invest in the airline. And then it turned out, again, remember the movie? They decided to strip the airline of all of its money and the union assets and give most of them to Gordon and some to Charlie, and the union went into bankruptcy. And during the 80s and through today, a lot of shareholder activism is about taking the company and readjusting its financial position so that you can move money quickly to shareholders from other sources.
And the shareholder meetings where this occurs aren't typically as exciting as what we saw in Wall Street. That is generally how a lot of these get decided, or at least the threat of a shareholder meeting where the shareholder is putting forth alternative board nominees. And then there's an election. So it's very similar to political campaigns. So if you thought you were going to get a reprieve from a talk about an election in this session, you're going to be disappointed, because it's very similar. We sometimes have hanging chads. We sometimes look at signatures, and we definitely always have swing states or swing investors that really will determine the outcome of election. But it's typically a small shareholder that is lobbying and trying to get other shareholders' support in order to get their agenda across.
What kind of organizations are targeted typically?
So every company, every publicly traded company is potentially a target for shareholder activism. No company is too big. A couple of years ago, Apple was a target for shareholder activism. I represented Hewlett Packard when it's been a target for shareholder activism. And no company is too small. It runs the gamut.
And it's not just the United States. I think if you asked us that question 15 years ago, we'd have a different answer. There were geographies where the investment climate or where the legal regime was not conducive to shareholder activism. But one of the things that we advise boards of directors, I'm sure David does the same, is it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And so you have to be prepared for shareholder activism if you are a public company.
And Derek brings up a great point. I mean, countries that you wouldn't think would have it, Japan, for example, is a very ripe target for companies for shareholder activists. You've seen the largest companies there, SoftBank, be a target of shareholder activism by an American activist, Elliott Management.
What are your typical activists trying to do? I mean, we've seen examples over generations, whether it's television or movies. At the time, it seemed like kind of obscure activities, whether it's somebody trying to get them to change their corporate governance or maybe trying to take money out of it. What is your typical activist, really, what are they targeting? What are they looking to accomplish?
Well, the activists that we're talking about, what they're really trying to drive is an increase in the stock price. And if you look at the things that they care about and that they're espousing, they really fall into a couple of different categories. One is what we would call, or what I would call, balance sheet activism, which is really trying to take the cash of the corporation and return it to shareholders, try to increase the amount of debt on the corporation. You have other activists that are really trying to encourage some transaction, typically a sale of the company or otherwise break up the company. And then the last category, it was really a broad catch-all, which is, I would say, operational activism, which includes things like cutting costs, changing the incentives of the sales force. But really all these things, they all have in common is that what these activists really care about is driving some change in the strategy, business, financials that will drive the stock price up.
And Josh mentioned at the beginning the Gordon Gekko analogy, which we like to joke about, but that's really true. I mean, shareholder activists focus on, for lack of a better word, as Gordon said, greed is good. They want to make stock price go up and money go back to shareholders. And that is a real change. It's really changed our corporate environment since the 1980s. And it has a dramatic effect. People don't notice it, but it's had a dramatic effect on the way the country operates. Because if you think about it, every dollar in corporate profits is divided. And it's divided between how it goes to employees, how it goes to stockholders, how it goes to the community, how it's reinvested in the corporation. And what's happened in the last 40 years is that most of the money that a corporation makes as a profit now goes to stockholders. And that shareholder activists, I mean, sort of push for that agenda, as Derek was describing.
But couldn't this be used as a way to, in the short, it seems like you'd have a short-term versus long-term problem potentially with what you're telling me. You would have potentially people manipulating the stock price to artificially inflate it, sell their shares. The long-term of the company may be dismal, but they have achieved their short-term objective. Is that a very cynical way to see it?
Cynical, but it may be accurate, at least to some extent. There is certainly, if you look at the shareholder base of a public corporation, there are many different types of shareholders. There are some shareholders like index funds who will own the company as long as it's in the index. So they are thinking of being an owner for decades. And if you look at the average holding for a shareholder activist, it's maybe 1, maybe 2 years at most. And so there can absolutely be a difference in opinion in what's good for the company. And one of the things that we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years is those arguments that are solely about taking cash out of the company or increasing leverage are getting much less traction with the large investors, the big Fidelities and Vanguards of the world, who are going to be owning the stock for a much longer time. So the arguments that people are making have migrated in order to accommodate for that.
Because the other thing we've seen over the last several decades is a really dramatic way of how people own stock, right? There was a time, again, going back to Gordon Gekko, when individuals owned stock, when people, you know, owned the stock of their companies in their backyard and were very proud of that. Over the last 40 to 50 years, that has now changed. Most people in this country, to the extent they own stock, they don't own it directly. So most people don't own Apple stock or Google stock or anything. They own stock in Fidelity. They own mutual funds that are part of Fidelity portfolio or part of Vanguard or State Street. And so it's those large institutional investors that control well over half of the stock owned in the United States. Indirectly, they own it. They own it for other people, but they're the ones making the voting decisions.
So are these people trying to shift what the company is doing financially? Are they trying to put themselves in a position of being on the board or being officers? And is it all different? What is their, if you were to sit down with them and say, what is your end game? What do you expect them to say?
Well, we do sit down with them. And typically they are driving, as Derek said, they want to drive to some type of financial change in the company, some type of performance agenda. And so they will come, as Derek mentioned, with a political platform. And that platform, like Democrats and Republicans, their platform is geared towards typically a financial change. So they think the company is spending too much on research and development, or the company is not has too many employees and they want to change that, or some other type of things that will result in an increased stock price if it changes its performance. Now, they will also have often some types of governance changes, but their primary motivation is financial.
Well, are they looking to go down on the football field and play, or are they looking to call the Super Bowl the next day, is I guess what I'm asking.
Yeah, generally, when they're looking for change, they're not. Most activists are not looking necessarily to get a board seat for themselves or for their fund. They generally these days, which is very different than 10 or 15 years ago, when they're nominating alternative directors, they tend to be independent of the fund, and they tend to be much higher quality than they were, you know, a decade ago. So they're at the end of the day, for most of them, they're looking for some sort of economic change. David mentioned. They also do talk about governance. They do talk about diversity in the boardroom. They do talk about these other issues. Not that they care about them per se, but they know that they only own 5 or 10% of a company and they need to get all the other shareholders on board. And they know that the likes of the pension funds and some of the big institutions do really care about these issues. So they will bring them up. And then when they put forth board candidates, one of the same things we've seen over the last couple of years is they've been much more diverse from a gender perspective. And they're responding to it. So they do bring these other issues up and they do press them. But it's really more, as David said, as part of a political campaign to achieve what they really want, which is some sort of business or strategic change.
Does it often come with a fair dose of, for lack of a better term, nearsightedness?
So in my experience, the answer is yes. Although I will tell you that there's a lot of academics out there who would debate that. But I think what's clearly happened, if you were to ask any business executive, you know, one of the big changes is that you now have to meet your numbers on Wall Street, right? You know, we get that you can't not pick up a business section of a newspaper or listening to the earnings results. And if someone doesn't meet their numbers, their stock price declines. And the reason for that is because you have these activists. And what happens is if you don't meet these numbers, you know, an activist is likely to pounce on you. And so you're in a lot of trouble. So, yeah, it leads businesses to act with a very short-term mentality so they can meet their numbers and avoid having the activists attack them. And there's even a term for it.
Actually. Have you seen businesses go out of business then? And they know it's wrong, but concentrating in the short term to either appease or prevent shareholder activism, but then they've destroyed the long term.
There have been situations, and this goes back to the increased debt return cash to shareholders, and this is where the longer-term institutions are less supportive for that very reason. That may make a lot of sense when times are good, But having a cushion going into March of this year was very beneficial. And those companies that had some sort of cushion, some sort of conservatism in their balance sheet, fared much better than those companies that didn't. So you absolutely will see companies that have been the subject of activism, that type of activism, that will perform much worse in a downturn.
You will also see a lot of companies. One of the things activism has led to is a lot of companies doing what's called a going private. They're being sold to what's firms that are called private equity firms because they don't want to go through the process of having a very fluctuating stock price. And so rather than face the risk of having activists come after them, they will sell themselves to a bigger company, or they will take other steps to try and avoid activism. So in Silicon Valley, we have a lot of companies, particularly very successful, recently public companies who have gone public with what's called dual class stock, right? Where insiders own stock that has more votes per share than the stock that sold to public stockholders. And the reason for that is so that when activists buy the public stock, they can't have such a great influence on how a company is doing. Because remember, it's an election. In a corporate election, what matters is how much money you have. That is, how many shares of stock you own. And the way to change that is by having a different class of stock that has more votes per share.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Joining me tonight, Josh Borger. Tonight we're discussing shareholder activism. Buy yourself some shares and make some trouble from within. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to shareholder activism. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in the conversation. And I did it again. I neglected to mention our attorneys are more than happy to guide you in the legal principles that are, you know, that will help guide your decision making. But we're not giving precise legal advice. We don't know all the factors, all the facts involved in your individual case. But again, we're more than happy to guide you in your decision making. Again, our number is 866-798-8255. One of the things we haven't talked about are some of the people that are affected by activism. Does it affect employees? What about people who don't own stock?
The answer there is clearly yes. Again, remember what I said earlier. Company makes a dollar in profits. The question is, how is that dollar divided, right? Does 90 cents go to stockholders, leaving 10 cents for the company to invest and pay its employees and do all of the other things that we want to do? Or is it divided so that more goes to employees and to the community and to return to the company in the form of R&D and other investment and less to stockholders? To the extent we have a greater environment for stockholder activism, typically it limits the amount that's paid to employees. And you saw that just the other day. So Home Depot, company we all love, great company. Everybody's using it now that we're in this COVID environment, announced that it had a great quarter, but it was going to pay its employees more and give them more pay because of the COVID crisis and all of that. And their stock price declined because they were going to give a greater share of their profits to employees. Now that makes an oddity in our system, but also if it wasn't for Home Depot and their structures, might make them more vulnerable to stockholder activists.
There's often a debate. There is a large debate in the academic literature about whether stockholder activism, shareholder activism creates value. But to the extent that it does, there was one study that basically looked at the manufacturing productivity of firms that were targeted by activists. And you could see that productivity before the activists showed up go down, and then when the activists showed up, go up. And I can guarantee productivity was not increasing because the activist came in and was giving a rah-rah pep talk and getting everybody excited to work more and be more productive. It was because there were shutdowns, whether they were caused by the activist or whether the activist invested at the time when that was going to happen at that stage in the business. It occurs. It also is the case that activists call for sales of companies. And when a company is sold, generally speaking, there's going to be some overlap in functions and there's going to be some employee loss. But it's not limited to the rank and file. It's also true for the C-suite, the management, especially the CEO. So when an activist comes in and has a difference of opinion on the strategy or something about the business, at their core, they are disagreeing with what the company's doing now and the path that the CEO is taking them on. If you look at the numbers, the likelihood a CEO leaves in the first 12 months after an activist shows up is three times as likely as any other average time in the corporation's life cycle. So it's not limited to it's also not limited to CEO and also to board members, but it really affects the entire organization when an activist shows up.
And just to be fair about this, it's not to say that activists never play a good or important role, right? I mean, every situation is unique, and you can have situations where activists come in where a company is not performing properly or a company, you know, a management team is taking too much money for itself, and an activist can do a great deal of good. So each situation, we should add, really is independent. But I think as a general matter, the activists have caused a lot of damage to employees and to companies and really changed the way companies operate.
Well, let me run with them doing some good for a second. And of course, you two both represent companies for a living, not the activists. But I had an understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that there are certain aspects of shareholder activism that target social change. They want the company to change environmental policies for the better, for the protection of the environment, perhaps respond more positively to the Me Too movement, perhaps respond with respect to racial justice, respond in a way that I think most people will consider to be socially beneficial. Is that not also part of social activism?
So that's a very fair question. That's a very fair question. What Derek and I have been talking about is primarily financial activists thus far. You are entirely correct that there is a different group that I will call social activists that focus on a variety of social issues, ranging from racial issues, racial justice, to environmental change. You don't see them as frequently taking a large position and having as significant an impact on companies as economic activists, as financial activists. But what we are seeing is state pension funds and other organizations like that put up greater demand for it. So, for example, the California retirement funds have been pushing for greater gender diversity on boards. And of course, California this past year just passed legislation requiring greater racial diversity on boards. And so those are the types of issues that we do see, the kind of activism that you're talking about. And that's a very different style of activism.
Well, let me keep going with that. Just putting it all in purely financial terms, responding positively to a lot of these movements will prevent lawsuits where the company has to pay out. Responding positively so that you have less people being sued for harassment due to the Me Too movement, due to a lot of things. If people are more sensitive, you're not getting sued as much, and financially that is for the better. As representatives of the company, how do you respond what do you tell the company to do in response to the Me Too movement, in response to what we're seeing with racial justice, in order to, well, you tell me how to respond.
Yeah, there's a big focus on that, particularly in technology firms, financial firms, firms that were historically very male dominated, and companies are focused on it. The big, most visible places within the company where there is external focus are the board of directors and the senior management team. And there has been a massive change in the in the demand for diverse candidates at the board of director level over the last several years. And that has changed both in terms of the number of and types of folks that companies are putting on their boards. It's also changed the types of folks that activists are looking for when they are trying to put people on the board in order to get the support of other investors. So you're seeing a significant change at the board level. There's also pressure or conversations about greater, you know, in the senior management ranks, in the management ranks, but because that is a, you know, not the key focus of economic activism, at least, you don't see that come up as much of an issue as the board does. But the board and the composition of the board, we have a term in the corporate governance world, pale, male, and stale, which means old white men. And if that's what the board looks like, then that is very attractive from a targeting perspective for an activist.
That's absolutely right. There are certain things that make a company ripe for an activist attack. And one of the first ones is the pale, male, and stale board. You know, over the last few years, I think there's now not a single company in the S&P 500 that has an all-white male board. I think everyone has at least some diversity.
And is that because the companies are recognizing it's for the better that you have diversity, or because you have activists that were using that as a chip in some way to get to a different objective?
So
that might be a jaded question again.
Well, I think you're omitting one player, right? So I think both of those are a factor. Clearly, companies recognize that they are a better company. There's no question. Every study shows that a company performs better if it's got a more diverse leadership structure. No question about it. But the player that you're missing is the institutional investor, the asset manager that we were mentioning earlier, the Fidelities of the world, Vanguards, State Streets, the California Teachers Funds. All of those investors who have very large stakes are demanding that the companies they invest in change their leadership to become a more diverse leadership. And that's been an enormously positive good.
I just received a message from a caller who asked me to ask the following question. We've been talking as though we're discussing American corporations. And the caller wanted to ask both of you how shareholder activism can be weaponized and perhaps used against Chinese corporations, whether it's TikTok or Alibaba, whatever it may be.
Well, it depends on the jurisdiction, but at the end of the day, the lever, the hammer that shareholder activists typically have is the ability to nominate directors and propose an alternate number of people who will control the board. So if you have the ability to do that, you will have shareholder activism and you will have shareholders putting forth alternative views. If you're in jurisdictions, and China may be one, where you don't have that ability to do that, or it's a company with dual class stock where the founders own a majority, you don't have that same ability. And in those situations, those are the rare public companies in those situations, which are actually immune from shareholder activism. But it is a rare geography and a rare set of companies that fulfill this criteria.
I also add that my understanding, and it just happened just before we went on the air, is that President Trump today announced a limitation on companies that Americans can hold stock in China. I haven't fully read the executive order that he issued, but it supposedly hit at a number of large Chinese companies, preventing U.S. citizens from owning stock in these companies. And of course, that would completely eliminate the ability for activists in the U.S. to take any role in Chinese companies.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Mm-hmm. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So we've been talking about corporate activism, that is, buy some stock, make some trouble, perhaps. Perhaps we're really bringing people into the fold, a chance to really accomplish some good. Whatever it may be, come and talk to my guests. Our number, if you're in the San Francisco area, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. David, you were just talking about the executive order. Doesn't that do exactly the opposite of what the president would want?
Is, and if you can't own stock in Chinese companies, you can't be an activist in it. But I haven't seen the order, and you know, I really just read the quick summary of it. And so, but yes, it would seem to be contradictory of what Trump says he wants.
And I think that also occurs in the world of governance shareholder activism. So if you're an institutional fund or an investor, and you own stock in a fossil fuel company, and you are a strong believer in reining in that and climate change and combating that, do you sell your stock, in which case you don't have a voice and you're making a protest vote, or do you keep it and you try to engage with the company and try to actually make change? And people take different views on it, but there's a number of folks that do sell the stock, but then you lose your voice, you lose your seat at the table, which sounds like exactly what might be happening with this executive order.
It's that Derek actually raises a great point. I'm old enough to remember when divestment was the key, and it's, you know, there was a big movement to divest of stocks owned in South Africa. Now there's some movement to divest of oil company stocks and the like, and easy to understand and why people would want to do that. The flip side to it, as Derek mentioned, is you do lose a voice. And what we've seen, for example, with a lot of European companies is that large institutions are pushing, for example, European car companies and coal companies to become carbon neutral in a way that you haven't yet seen here. And so it is very possible for institutional investors to have a very strong say and push companies to move in a way that considers externalities that historically over the last half century have not been considered in U.S. companies.
Well, I don't want to misquote Jeff. I think when we came back from the break, he might have said that we were talking about change for good. It seems like everything I'm hearing over the last half an hour is very subjective over whether it's good. It depends on who you are and where you're sitting at that moment. Let me ask you, because I don't think this has always been the way Wall Street has been played, but maybe I'm wrong. Where did shareholder activism come from? And then I'm also sitting here thinking, how come Abby Hoffman and his friends didn't buy stock in some company during the Vietnam War and show up and raise holy hell?
So the historical development of shareholder activism, I mean, depends on how far back you want to go, and I don't think we have enough time to go all the way back tonight. But really, again, there was limited activism in the 50s and 60s in the post-war years. It really got its start in the 1970s and then tuning into the 80s when some very colorful characters on Wall Street, you know, decided to go after companies. You know, Ivan Boesky, Michael Milken, Ron Perlman, was an activist before he took over Revlon. And they really were primarily financially motivated, T. Boone Pickens. And what they were trying to do is what was called unlock value and really change the way companies were operated. And from that morphed what is, you know, sort of came the governance movement. And these former corporate raiders became governance folks. And that's what's sort of led to the activist movement today.
If it used to be, there used to be the hostile raiders. And this is to take Carl Icahn as an example. Here is somebody who himself was a hostile raider, rebranded over the course of 20 years, and now is a shareholder activist, champion of shareholder rights, trying to, you know, create value at companies. So they've done a tremendous job as the activism industry has gotten more mature. They've done a tremendous job at branding what they are doing in a much different light than the way it was viewed back in the 80s.
Not sure if you're telling me shareholder activism is a young man's game. As I get older, I feel myself moving towards the middle a little more. Is that what happens with activists like the rest of us? You start, you become comfortable with where you are and you start moving away from your position?
You know, I was just going to say the range of ages of activism probably goes from 23 to 92. If you look at where Carl is now, 86, somewhere in that range. So certainly the number of activist funds has exploded over the last decade, and that leads to a younger population. There's now, I think in 2019, there was $200 billion in activism funds, and over 250 activist different funds had at least one activist campaign in 2019. So you really have had, and that's really what's driven a lot of the change, an explosion in the asset class, where everybody is trying to crawl over each other and be the first one to be the activist at a specific
company. Well, let me ask you about how you would go about it if you're the activist, whether for social change or for financial change. It could be a shareholder resolution, I guess a proxy fight. You could go to the streets with publicity campaigns. You could just call up management with a bunch of people, enough people they might listen and say, we want to negotiate. You could just turn around, I guess, and craft a derivative lawsuit. How do they go about it? Or is the answer yes?
No. Well, today, a lot of the activists are very, very sophisticated. So it used to be a wide variety of different ways. But today what typically happens, just because of a whole bunch of legal developments and market developments, is an activist will do a lot of research and then come to a company privately. And they will have purchased anywhere from 2 to 4.5% of the company's stock. And I say 4.5 because once an activist owns 5% of a company's stock, they have to disclose it. So prior to the time they disclose it, they will typically come to the company privately and propose a dialogue where they're going to say, here's what you as a company should do. Here's how you should change your operations. And that dialogue can last for quite some time. And depending on the company's response and the activist's proposals, it can either go public, it can stay private, the activist can go away. There's a whole bunch of things can happen. That's often how the first approach is made.
And the truth is, we've talked a lot about proxy contests and elections because those are more exciting and interesting. But the truth is that most activism is settled before it gets that far, whether it's come public or private. Both the company and the activist agree on some set of changes going forward, and then they move on with life. Rarely does it actually get to the point where you have a really hostile public campaign. But when it does, it can be very hostile, and there can be a lot of very much remind you of a political campaign. One of my favorite tactics that I've seen an activist do is during one of these campaigns, they purchased billboard space and all the billboards from the CEO's home to work and put quotes about him and quotes about the company all the way. So these are the types of political type campaigning that occurs in these types of situations.
And they're very strictly regulated. So you have to understand, the Securities and Exchange Commission has a number of rules that govern how these campaigns are run. State law, depending on where the company is incorporated, has a number of rules that decide how these campaigns are run. And there's a number of other rules and regulations that can play on how these things happen. And all of these also impact the company's employees and customers, which are affected greatly by how these campaigns are run.
We had a caller. We seem to have lost it. Rufus, if you want to call us back, feel free. But he did ask two questions that I will pass along. The first is, and this is Rufus in Pacifica, asking the cost to buy in if you want to be an activist and cause change.
So it depends on what size company you want to go after. And but usually, you know, again, we're talking public companies. A small public company today usually has a market cap of, you know, several hundred million dollars. And if you want to own 1% of that small public company so that you can start your campaign, it's a lot of money.
The other question that Rufus asked was, how many votes does it typically take to make that kind of change?
Well, it's typically, in most cases, you're trying to get more shareholders to support you than not. So for those shareholders that do show up, you want to get the majority support. Now, as I mentioned before, most of these situations settle before it gets to a vote. So what you really need in most cases is just a substantial number of shareholders that are also upset, where there's the possibility that they could vote against the corporation. And generally speaking, you will end up with some sort of an amicable agreement between the two parties. But if it does get to a vote, it is typically the way that it works is the highest vote getters will get in.
Again, think of it as the U.S. election, right? You don't need a majority. You just need more than the next guy or gal who's you're running against. In a activist campaign, usually there's 10% or 15% of the stockholders never vote. So you're talking about winning 50.1% of those who voted.
One of the questions I was looking towards is how this might look different, how it might appear differently in different industries. But let's circle back to Rufus's model for a moment. How might the entry to get in to gain this type of control, how would that differ from industry to industry?
Well, I think the biggest difference is size. In terms of the, you know, getting in, I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of difference based on, you know, how much money you need. It's really more about the size of the company. But the types of things that you can do in different industries are very different. So take an extreme case. If you look at utility industry or the insurance industry or the banking industry, and these are industries where you have regulators that are there to protect other constituencies beyond shareholders. So it's in policyholders in the case of insurance industry or ratepayers. Now, there is activism there, but it is fairly limited. So there's a few industries where it's very, very different. Energy is one. I'm sure David can talk about the differences in technology in Silicon Valley. But energy is one where it's tough to be an activist because you could be right on some of the changes you suggest. But if the oil price doubles or gets cut in half, that's going to drive stock price much more than your argument. So you do have sometimes different activists in different industries, and a lot of times different ideas and different arguments, depending on the industry.
The other thing from Rufus's perspective is most of these activists are managing other people's money. So it's, again, Carl Icahn is an exception and he can do it with his own money. But a large percentage, particularly of these smaller activists, have funds. So they've gotten other people to invest in them because they're able to convince someone else or a group of other folks that they can manage their money and be successful in their activist attacks. So part of what they're thinking of doing and part of what their game plan is, in addition to trying to turn around the company or gain some benefit there, is to create a track record so that they can raise money for a larger fund.
No, it's a great point. The vast majority of activists are hedge funds. You do have some traditional institutional investors. You do have some people using their own money, but it is by far and wide much more a feature of a hedge fund than anything else.
Well, let's talk about a name that we all, know, love, hear about everywhere you turn. Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
Infamous Warren Buffett. Is he an activist?
He used to be. I mean, he had done it occasionally in the past. I think he certainly migrated over time and built his image and done a good job in changing his investment style. But he has done some, you know, I think pre-80s. But since then, now he's more buying companies, doing some investment, but not necessarily being one that's driving change and trying to get other shareholders on board.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, again, one of the things that has to be recognized here is the way the rules of the game play. You know, we're talking about things that activists do, but it goes to the rules that all apply. And these rules could change very dramatically. We've got a new administration coming in, and that could have a big impact on how activists are able to proceed and what they're able to do.
Well, what changes do you anticipate in a Biden administration?
Well, we know we're going to have a new chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. One of the questions that's up front right now is we've lived in an era of stockholder primacy over the last 40 years. That's being looked at as to whether the debate now is so-called stakeholder capitalism, right? They're inclusive capitalism, a capitalism that gives greater benefits to all of the people who have a stake in the company, the employees, the communities, and the like. And I think we can expect a Biden administration that's going to focus more on those stakeholders, and that's going to impact the way activists are able to attack companies.
You know, even before the administration potentially changes, we've had some recent changes that may have already shown us how some of these changes take place. How's the arrival of things such as the COVID-19 pandemic impacted shareholder activism?
Yeah, COVID, it changed. The spring was very, very different this year than it is. And typically the spring is a busy time for shareholder activism because most companies have end their years on December 31st. And so the spring is typically where you have your annual meetings where you elect directors. And so having COVID arrive in March really, really chilled a lot of the activity. You saw the campaigns that continued to be campaigns that were really kind of longer term campaigns where this was just the last step, or where the activists thought they had a really strong thesis and were going for perhaps control of the company. So one of the things that an activist do, where they have a choice when they're trying to take some seats on the board, either to go for control and get a majority of the seats, or to go for less than control. The less than control is much more common, but that was very different than this year. It was only the ones where the activists felt they had a really strong thesis. But since that time, the downturn was in the markets was very short. Very few activists went out of business, which is very different than the 2008, 2009 timeframe. And so what we've seen over the last 2-3 months is a lot of activists having a lot of money and really coming back with a vengeance and trying to find something to do at a lot of companies. At the end of the day, if you're an activist and you're getting paid to be an activist, you can't sit there and cash and wait forever. And so there's a big incentive to put that money to work. And we've seen a lot of activity over the last couple of months.
And that we expect you'll see a lot more. Because as we mentioned earlier, you know, these are hedge funds. These are folks who need to put their money to work. And they do it by taking a position in a company and trying to have that company change its operations.
In general, should a board of directors see activism as a threat? Should they normally, or do they normally see it as a benefit, possibly something that can give them a boost? And what advice, if any, would you give to directors and officers about shareholder activism?
Well, so what I tell directors is you need to separate the messenger from the message. And, you know, activists are a clock, and sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. And, you know, they like, you should plan and run your company as you believe in your business judgment is the right way to run the company. And that's for the long term. And if you do that, your other stockholders, the majority of your stockholders, will follow along. The problem that activists have created, and it's a problem more globally in our markets, is that we tend to be too short-term oriented. Companies have to perform well every quarter to quarter, as opposed to thinking, you know, what's best for the company in 2-3 years. And that's the problem we need to fix.
And it's often helpful. We just talked about what happens when an activist shows up. But that's the minority of cases. It's 5 to 10% maybe of corporations, public corporations, face activism in a given year. But for the rest of them, it's often helpful, and we've seen this over the last 5 or 6 years, to think about the world through the lens of an activist. Be your own activist was the phrase that was popularized about, you know, 5 years ago. How would an activist look at your company? What do your other shareholders think about it? Now, it doesn't mean that you have to agree with them. It doesn't mean that what you're, you know, through that lens is the right answer. But it is helpful to look through that lens when you're thinking about strategy, when you're thinking about taking significant steps. One, because it could attract an activist, but two is, you know, as David said, sometimes they're right. And so looking through that lens and getting feedback from other shareholders can be helpful as part of the board deliberation process.
And the challenge that, and that's entirely, I mean, Derek and I often give similar advice, but the challenge that is, what the way an activist often looks at you is, how am I going to get the most cash out of the company quickly? And as the board wants to look at it, you know, we would hope that a board takes a longer view and looks at the stakeholders of the company, not just giving the most cash to stockholders.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point, and it depends on what type of thesis. So if you're thinking about the level of cash and financial security, there's probably going to be a pretty different opinion between most shareholder activists and the company. If you're thinking about whether the business should be separated, if you're thinking about other strategic questions, there may be more commonality than the case of whether that you should keep excess cash.
This has been a very fascinating discussion. I'd like to pick it up where we're leaving off, but we are running low on time, and I wanted to give each of you 3 or 4 minutes. Unfortunately, we don't have any more than that, but about 3 minutes for any closing thoughts. Derek, want to go first?
And you have to close by analogizing to Wall Street. We end where we started. So go.
That's going to be really tough. I'm trying to think of an analogy for Bud Fox or whatnot. I think the biggest point about shareholder activism is this is something that is here for the long term. There has been a dramatic increase in engagement and involvement and shareholders expressing their voice over the last 20 years. At that same point, you have had these institutions become more and more concentrated. So shareholder bases are now full of big institutional investors that are willing to express their viewpoints. That is a one-way street. That is not going to change. So if you look at your crystal ball and look 5-10 years in the future, you can imagine different forms of activism. But the concept of shareholders raising their hands and expressing their viewpoints, sometimes very vocally and very aggressively, that's not going away.
So when I think of this thing, so first, thank you for having us on. Having me on, it's been a great pleasure and a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
You know, I love the movie Wall Street, and I remember Bud's disillusionment at the end. And my goal, when I think of stockholder activism, and particularly when I think of the new administration coming in, I'm hoping we figure out a way for corporations to measure externalities, right? What we need to do, the problem with activists is they're focused solely on a company's stock price and financial return. And they're focused on that because that's right now the only thing we're really good at measuring. And if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And what we need to do is figure out a way to measure things like, how does a company treat its employees? How does it take care and ensure that it's meeting needs of racial justice and handle climate change and carbon emissions? And we need to manage all of these other externalities. And if we can do that and figure out a way to measure that, then companies will be measured on their performance regarding these externalities. And then we can have activists push companies to be better corporate citizens. And that's what I think would be great. And I think the new administration hopefully will push in that direction.
You've used line externalities a couple of times. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by externalities? Econ majors like myself, I know what those are, but I think some of our listeners may be interested in hearing.
Sure. What I mean by that is, you know, how does a company, an externality is simply something that's not typically measured in the company's balance sheet. So how does a company do on it, making sure that it satisfies its goals of racial justice? How does a company make sure that it's meeting its goals for to meet the demands of climate change and carbon neutrality? How does a company do with respect to making sure that its employees are well paid and that it's treating all of its workers, not just employees, but, you know, contract workers and the like, fairly? You know, those are the types of issues that we want companies to look at when it thinks about all of its stakeholders. And so I'm thinking of stakeholders as the externalities for a company.
Yeah, I think another example is very specifically climate change, which is a great example of externalities. If you're a specific company, the cost, the benefit you get from lowering carbon costs or reducing fossil fuel, they're shared by everybody. So you may pay all the costs for your share, but everybody benefits with a reduction in climate change. So the externality is the benefits that are gotten by everybody else. But if you could ever get everybody to band together, so if you're a Vanguard or a BlackRock or State Street that owns every single company, and you can get every single company to do it, they're all better off. But the problem is, for any individual company, you share in only a fraction of the benefits and have all of the cost. And that's really the problem when we talk about externalities. Climate change, I think, is a great one, because it really is the case that these big institutions are pushing for the climate change, for all these companies to be focused on it, because otherwise the companies won't be. And it's better off for everybody if everybody pitches in and shares some of the cost.
Josh, do you want to take a moment for any closing thoughts?
I will say this is not what I thought it was going to be at the very beginning of the show. Just to reiterate what I thought shareholder activism is, I'm going to go home and rewatch Wall Street. And now that I can point out that Gordon Gekko was a shareholder activist was absolutely not when I started, I hope everyone here learned as much as I did, that it is far more complex and there is far more than simply changing company for social good. It can also be someone gutting it.
I do have to join you with that. This is very different than the conversation I thought we would be having tonight. I remember from when I was a child watching a sitcom where somebody bought a share of a department store stock, showed up at the shareholders meeting, and started a dialogue about why they should stand behind what had been really chintzy product line. At the end, having convinced everybody they needed to completely revamp the operation, she was asked and said, "Oh, yes, we chipped in and bought a share." Thank you both. This has been a very, very fascinating conversation. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been discussing shareholder activism. Our guests tonight have been Derek Zaba, a partner and co-chair of the shareholder activism practice at Sidley Austin, LLP, and attorney David Berger, a partner and chair of the local governance at Wilson Sonsini, Goodrich & Rosati. I'd like to thank both of you for joining us tonight. Our show tonight has been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. Once again, our thanks to Derek Zaba and David Berger and to Josh Borger. And especially our thanks to all of you for listening, for joining us in tonight. And at the controls, Debbie Kennedy. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.